stood out from the court on one side. On the other, a beech avenue screened it from the lawn. At the bottom was a sunk fence, its sole separation from lonely fields. A winding walk bordered with laurels and terminating in a giant horse chestnut, circled at the base by a seat, led down to the fence. Here one could wander unseen. While such honeydew fell, such silence reigned, such gloaming gathered, I felt as if I could haunt such shade forever. But in threading the flower and fruit parterres at the upper part of the enclosure, enticed there by the light, the now rising moon cast on this more open quarter, my step is stayed, not by sound, not by sight, but once more by a warning fragrance. Sweetbriar and southernwood, jasmine, pink, and rose have long been yielding their evening sacrifice of incense. This new scent is neither of shrub nor flower. It is, I know it well, it is Mr. Rochester's cigar. I look round and I listen. I see trees laden with ripening fruit. I hear a nightingale warbling in a wood half a mile off. No moving form is visible, no coming step audible, but that perfume increases. I must flee. I make for the wicket leading to the shrubbery, and I see Mr. Rochester entering. I step aside into the ivy recess. He will not stay long. He will soon return whence he came, and if I sit still, he will never see me. But no, eventide is as pleasant to him as to me, and this antique garden as attractive. And he strolls on, now lifting the gooseberry tree branches to look at the fruit, large as plums, with which they are laden. Now taking a ripe cherry from the wall. Now stooping towards a knot of flowers, either to inhale their fragrance or to admire the dew beads on their petals. A great moth goes humming by me. It alights on a plant at Mr. Rochester's foot. He sees it and bends to examine it. Now he has his back towards me, thought I, and he is occupied too. Perhaps if I walk softly I can slip away unnoticed. I trod on an edging of turf that the crackle of the pebbly gravel might not betray me. He was standing among the beds at a yard or two distant from where I had to pass. The moth apparently engaged him. I shall get by very well, I meditated. As I crossed his shadow, thrown long over the garden by the moon, not yet risen high, he said quietly, without turning, Jane, come and look at this fellow. I had made no noise. He had not eyes behind. Could his shadow feel? I started at first, and then I approached him.
Look at his wings, said he. He reminds me rather of a West Indian insect. One does not often see so large and gay a night rover in England. There, he has flown.
The moth roamed away. I was sheepishly retreating also, but Mr. Rochester followed me, and when we reached the wicket, he said,
Turn back. On so lovely a night it is a shame to sit in the house, and surely no one can wish to go to bed while sunset is thus at meeting with moonrise.
It is one of my faults, that though my tongue is sometimes prompt enough at an answer, there are times when it sadly fails me in framing an excuse, and always the lapse occurs at some crisis, when a facile word or plausible pretext is specially wanted to get me out of painful embarrassment. I did not like to walk at this hour alone with Mr. Rochester in the shadowy orchard, but I could not find a reason to allege for leaving him. I followed with lagging step, and thoughts busily bent on discovering a means of extrication, but he himself looked so composed and so grave also, I became ashamed of feeling any confusion. The evil, if evil, existent or prospective there was, seemed to lie with me only. His mind was unconscious and quiet.
Jane,
he recommenced, as we entered the laurel walk, and slowly strayed down in the direction of the sunk fence and the horse chestnut.
Thornfield is a pleasant place in summer, is it not?
Yes, sir.
You must have become in some degree attached to the house. You, who have an eye for natural beauties, and a good deal of the organ of adhesiveness.
I am attached to it, indeed.
And though I don't comprehend how it is, I perceive you have acquired a degree of regard for that foolish little child Adele, too. And even for simple Dame Fairfax.
Yes, sir, in different ways. I have an affection for both.
And would be sorry to part with them.
Yes.
Pity,
he said, and sighed, and paused.
It is always the way of events in this life,
he continued presently.
No sooner have you got settled in a pleasant resting place than a voice calls out to you to rise and move on, for the hour of repose is expired.
Must I move on, sir? I asked. Must I leave Thornfield?
I believe you must, Jane. I am sorry, Janet, but I believe indeed you must.
This was a blow, but I did not let it prostrate me. Well, sir, I shall be ready when the order to march comes.
It is come now. I must give it tonight.
Then you are going to be married, sir.
Exactly. Precisely. With your usual acuteness, you have hit the nail straight on the head.
Soon, sir?
Very soon, that is, Miss Eyre. And you'll remember, Jane, the first time rumor, plainly intimated to you that it was my intention to put my old bachelor's neck into the sacred noose, to enter into the holy estate of matrimony, to take Miss Ingram to my bosom, in short. She's an extensive armful, but that's not to the point. One can't have too much of such a very excellent thing as my beautiful Blanche. Well, as I was saying, listen to me, Jane. You're not turning your head to look after more moths, are you? That was only a lady clock child flying away home. I wish to remind you that it was you who first said to me, with that discretion I respect in you, with that foresight, prudence, and humility which befit your responsible and dependent position, that in case I married Miss Ingram, both you and little Adele had better trot forthwith. I pass over the sort of slur conveyed in this suggestion on the character of my beloved. Indeed, when you are far away, Janet, I'll try to forget it. I shall notice only its wisdom, which is such that I have made it my law of action. Adele must go to school, and you, Miss Eyre, must get a new situation.
Yes, sir. I will advertise immediately. And meantime, I suppose I may stay here till I find another shelter to betake myself to. But I stopped, feeling it would not do to risk a long sentence, for my voice was not quite under command.
In about a month, I hope to be a bridegroom,
continued Mr. Rochester.
And in the interim, I shall myself look out for employment and an asylum for you.
Thank you, sir. I am sorry to give...
Oh, no need to apologize. I consider that when a dependent does her duty as well as you have done yours, she has a sort of claim upon her employer for any little assistance he can conveniently render her. Indeed, I have already, through my future mother-in-law, heard of a place that I think will suit. It is to undertake the education of the 5 daughters of Mrs. Dionysius O'Gall of Bitternut Lodge, Connaught, Ireland. You'll like Ireland, I think. They're such warm-hearted people there, they say.
It is a long way off, sir.
No matter. A girl of your sense will not object to the voyage or the distance.
Not the voyage, but the distance. And then the sea is a barrier.
From what, Jane?
From England, and from Thornfield, and...
Well?
From you, sir. I said this almost involuntarily, and, with as little sanction of free will, my tears gushed out. I did not cry so as to be heard, however. I avoided sobbing. The thought of Mrs. O'Gall and Bitternut Lodge struck cold to my heart, and colder the thought of all the brine and foam destined, as it seemed, to rush between me and the master at whose side I now walked, and coldest the remembrance of the wider ocean. Wealth, caste, custom intervened between me and what I naturally and inevitably loved.
It is a long way, I again said.
It is, to be sure. And when you get to Bitternut Lodge, Connaught, Ireland, I shall never see you again, Jane. That's morally certain. I never go over to Ireland, not having myself much of a fancy for the country. We have been good friends, Jane, have we not?
Yes, sir.
And when friends are on the eve of separation, they like to spend the little time that remains to them close to each other. Come, we'll talk over the voyage and the parting quietly half an hour or so. while the stars enter into their shining life up in heaven yonder. Here is the chestnut tree. Here is the bench at its old roots. Come, we will sit there in peace tonight, though we should never more be destined to sit there together.
He seated me and himself.
It is a long way to Ireland, Janet, and I am sorry to send my little friend on such weary travels. But if I can't do better, how is it to be helped? Are you anything akin to me, do you think, Jane?
I could risk no sort of answer by this time. My heart was still.
Because,
he said,
I sometimes have a queer feeling with regard to you, especially when you are near me, as now. It is as if I had a string somewhere under my left ribs, tightly and inextricably knotted to a similar string situated in the corresponding quarter of your little frame. And if that boisterous channel and 200 miles or so of land come broad between us, I am afraid that cord of communion will be snapped. And then I've a nervous notion I should take to bleeding inwardly. As for you, you'd forget me.
That I never should, sir. You know, impossible to proceed.
Jane, do you hear that nightingale singing in the wood? Listen.
In listening, I sobbed convulsively, for I could repress what I endured no longer. I was obliged to yield, and I was shaken from head to foot with acute distress. When I did speak, it was only to express an impetuous wish that I had never been born or never come to Thornfield.
Because you are sorry to leave it?
The vehemence of emotion, stirred by grief and love within me, was claiming mastery and struggling for full sway and asserting a right to predominate, to overcome, to live, rise and reign at last, yes, and to speak. I grieve to leave Thornfield. I love Thornfield. I love it, because I have lived in it a full and delightful life, momentarily at least. I have not been trampled on. I have not been petrified. I have not been buried with inferior minds, and excluded from every glimpse of communion with what is bright and energetic and high. I have talked face to face with what I reverence, with what I delight in, with an original, a vigorous and expanded mind. I have known you, Mr. Rochester, and it strikes me with terror and anguish to feel I absolutely must be torn from you forever. I see the necessity of departure, and it is like looking on the necessity of death.
Where do you see the necessity?
He asked suddenly.
Where? You, sir, have placed it before me.
In what shape?
In the shape of Miss Ingram, a noble and beautiful woman, your bride.
My bride? What bride? I have no bride.
But you will have.
Yes, I will. I will.
He set his teeth. Then I must go. You have said it yourself.
No, you must stay. I swear it. And the oath shall be kept.
I tell you I must go, I retorted, roused to something like passion. Do you think I can stay to become nothing to you? Do you think I am an automaton, a machine without feelings, and can bear to have my morsel of bread snatched from my lips, and my drop of living water dashed from my cup? Do you think because I am poor, obscure, plain, and little, I am soulless and heartless? You think wrong. I have as much soul as you, and full as much heart. And if God had gifted me with some beauty and much wealth, I should have made it as hard for you to leave me as it is now for me to leave you. I am not talking to you now through the medium of custom, conventionalities, nor even of mortal flesh. It is my spirit that addresses your spirit, just as if both had passed through the grave and we stood at God's feet equal. As we are.
As we are,
repeated Mr. Rochester.
So,
he added, enclosing me in his arms, gathering me to his breast, pressing his lips on my lips.
So, Jane.
Yes, so, sir,
I rejoined.
And yet not so. For you are a married man, or as good as a married man, and wed to one inferior to you, to one with whom you have no sympathy, whom I do not believe you truly love, for I have seen and heard you sneer at her. I would scorn such a union. Therefore I am better than you. Let me go!
Where, Jane? To Ireland?
Yes, to Ireland. I have spoken my mind and can go anywhere now.
Jane, be still. Don't struggle so. Like a wild, frantic bird that is rending its own plumage in its desperation.
I am no bird, and no net ensnares me. I am a free human being with an independent will, which I now exert to leave you.
Another effort set me at liberty, and I stood erect before him.
And your will shall decide your destiny, he said. I offer you my hand, my heart, and a share of all my possessions.
You play a farce,
which I merely laugh at. I ask you to pass through life at my side, to be my second self and best earthly companion.
For that fate you have already made your choice and must abide by it.
Jane, be still. A few moments, you are overexcited. I will be still, too.
A waft of wind came sweeping down the laurel walk and trembled through the boughs of the chestnut. It wandered away, away, to an indefinite distance. It died. The nightingale song was then the only voice of the hour. In listening to it, I again wept. Mr. Rochester sat quiet, looking at me gently and seriously. Some time passed before he spoke. He at last said,
"Come to my side, Jane, and let us explain and understand one another."
"I will never again come to your side. I am torn away now and cannot return."
"But, Jane, I summon you as my wife. It is you only I intend to marry."
I was silent. I thought he mocked me.
"Come, Jane. Come hither.
Your bride stands between us." He rose and with a stride reached me.
"My bride is here,"
he said, again drawing me to him.
"Because my equal is here, and my likeness. Jane, will you marry me?"
Still I did not answer, and still I writhed myself from his grasp, for I was still incredulous.
"Do you doubt me, Jane?"
"Entirely."
"You have no faith in me?"
"Not a whit."
"Am I a liar in your eyes?"
he asked passionately.
"Little skeptic, you shall be convinced. What love have I for Miss Ingram? None, and that you know. What love has she for me? None, as I have taken pains to prove. I caused a rumor to reach her that my fortune was not a third of what was supposed, and after that I presented myself to see the result. It was coldness from both her and her mother. I would not, I could not, marry Miss Ingram. You strange, you almost unearthly thing, I love as my own flesh. You, poor and obscure, and small and plain as you are, I entreat to accept me as a husband."
"What, me?"
I ejaculated, beginning in his earnestness, and especially in his incivility, to credit his sincerity.
"Me, who have not a friend in the world but you, if you are my friend, and not a shilling but what you have given me."
"You, Jane, I must have you for my own, entirely my own. Will you be mine? Say yes, quickly."
"Mr. Rochester, let me look at your face. Turn to the moonlight."
"Why?"
"Because I want to read your countenance. Turn."
"There. You will find it scarcely more legible than a crumpled, scratched page. Read on. Only make haste, for I suffer."
His face was very much agitated and very much flushed, and there were strong workings in the features and strange gleams in the eyes.
"Oh, Jane, you torture me,"
he exclaimed.
"With that searching and yet faithful and generous look, you torture me."
"How can I do that? If you are true and your offer real, my only feelings to you must be gratitude and devotion. They cannot torture.
Gratitude,
he ejaculated, and added wildly,
Jane, accept me quickly. Say, Edward, give me my name. Edward, I will marry you.
Are you in earnest? Do you truly love me? Do you sincerely wish me to be your wife?
I do. And if an oath is necessary to satisfy you, I swear it.
Then, sir, I will marry you.
Edward, my little wife.
Dear Edward!
Come to me. Come to me entirely now,
said he, and added, in his deepest tone, speaking in my ear as his cheek was laid on mine,
Make my happiness. I will make yours. God pardon me,
he subjoined ere long,
and man meddle not with me. I have her, and will hold her.
There is no one to meddle, sir. I have no kindred to interfere.
No, that is the best of it, he said.
And if I had loved him less, I should have thought his accent and look of exultation savage. But sitting by him, roused from the nightmare of parting, called to the paradise of union, I thought only of the bliss given me to drink in so abundant a flow. Again and again he said,
Are you happy, Jane?
And again I answered, Yes. After which he murmured,
It will atone. It will atone. Have I not found her friendless and cold and comfortless? Will I not guard and cherish and solace her? Is there not love in my heart and constancy in my resolves? It will expiate at God's tribunal. I know my Maker sanctions what I do. For the world's judgment, I wash my hands thereof. For man's opinion, I defy it.
But what had befallen the night? The moon was not yet set, and we were all in shadow. I could scarcely see my master's face, near as I was. And what ailed the chestnut tree? It writhed and groaned, while wind roared in the laurel walk and came sweeping over us.
We must go in, said Mr. Rochester. The weather changes. I could have sat with thee till morning, Jane.
And so, thought I, could I with you. I should have said so, perhaps, but a livid, vivid spark leapt out of a cloud at which I was looking, and there was a crack, a crash, and a close rattling peal, and I thought only of hiding my dazzled eyes against Mr. Rochester's shoulder. The rain rushed down. He hurried me up the walk, through the grounds, and into the house, but we were quite wet before we could pass the threshold. He was taking off my shawl in the hall, and shaking the water out of my loosened hair, when Mrs. Fairfax emerged from her room. I did not observe her at first, nor did Mr. Rochester. The lamp was lit. The clock was on the stroke of 12.
Hasten to take off your wet things, said he. And before you go, good night. Good night, my darling.
He kissed me repeatedly. When I looked up, on leaving his arms, there stood the widow, pale, grave, and amazed. I only smiled at her and ran upstairs. Explanation will do for another time, thought I. Still, when I reached my chamber, I felt a pang at the idea she should even temporarily misconstrue what she had seen. But joy soon effaced every other feeling, and loud as the wind blew, near and deep as the thunder crashed, fierce and frequent as the lightning gleamed, cataract-like as the rain fell during a storm of 2 hours' duration, I experienced no fear and little awe. Mr. Rochester came thrice to my door in the course of it, to ask if I was safe and tranquil, and that was comfort. That was strength for anything. Before I left my bed in the morning, little Adele came running in to tell me that the great horse chestnut at the bottom of the orchard had been struck by lightning in the night, and half of it split away. Chapter 24. As I rose and dressed, I thought over what had happened, and wondered if it were a dream. I could not be certain of the reality till I had seen Mr. Rochester again, and heard him renew his words of love and promise. While arranging my hair, I looked at my face in the glass, and felt it was no longer plain. There was hope in its aspect and life in its colour, and my eyes seemed as if they had beheld the fount of fruition and borrowed beams from the lustrous ripple. I had often been unwilling to look at my master, because I feared he could not be pleased at my look, but I was sure I might lift my face to his now, and not cool his affection by its expression. I took a plain but clean and light summer dress from my drawer and put it on. It seemed no attire had ever so well become me, because none had I ever worn in so blissful a mood. I was not surprised, when I ran down into the hall, to see that a brilliant June morning had succeeded to the tempest of the night, and to feel, through the open glass door, the breathing of a fresh and fragrant breeze. Nature must be gladsome when I was so happy. A beggar woman and her little boy, pale, ragged objects both, were coming up the walk, and I ran down and gave them all the money I happened to have in my purse, some 3 or 4 shillings. Good or bad, they must partake of my jubilee. The rooks cawed, and blither birds sang, but nothing was so merry or so musical as my own rejoicing heart. Mrs. Fairfax surprised me by looking out of the window with a sad countenance, and saying gravely,
"Miss Eyre, will you come to breakfast?"
During the meal she was quiet and cool,
but I could not undeceive her then. I must wait for my master to give explanations, and so must she. I ate what I could, and then I hastened upstairs. I met Adele leaving the schoolroom.
"Where are you going? It is time for lessons."
"Mr. Rochester has sent me away to the nursery."
"Where is he?"
"In there,"
pointing to the apartment she had left. And I went in, and there he stood.
"Come and bid me good morning," said he.
I gladly advanced, and it was not merely a cold word now, or even a shake of the hand that I received, but an embrace and a kiss. It seemed natural. It seemed genial to be so well loved, so caressed by him.
"Jane, you look blooming and smiling and pretty," said he. "Truly pretty this morning. Is this my pale little elf? Is this my mustard seed? This little sunny-faced girl with the dimpled cheek and rosy lips, the satin-smooth hazel hair and the radiant hazel eyes?" I had green eyes, reader, but you must excuse the mistake. For him they were new-dyed, I suppose.
"It is Jane Eyre, sir."
"Soon to be Jane Rochester," he added. "In 4 weeks, Janet, not a day more. Do you hear that?"
I did, and I could not quite comprehend it. It made me giddy. The feeling the announcement sent through me was something stronger than was consistent with joy, something that smote and stunned. It was, I think, almost fear.
"You blushed, and now you are white, Jane. What is that for?"
"Because you gave me a new name, Jane Rochester, and it seems so strange."
"Yes, Mrs. Rochester," said he. "Young Mrs. Rochester, Fairfax Rochester's girl bride."
"It can never be, sir. It does not sound likely. Human beings never enjoy complete happiness in this world. I was not born for a different destiny to the rest of my species. To imagine such a lot befalling me is a fairy tale, a daydream."
"Which I can and will realize. I shall begin today. This morning I wrote to my banker in London to send me certain jewels he has in his keeping, heirlooms for the ladies of Thornfield. In a day or two I hope to pour them into your lap, for every privilege, every attention shall be yours that I would accord a peer's daughter if about to marry her."
"Oh, sir, never rain jewels. I don't like to hear them spoken of. Jewels for Jane Eyre sounds unnatural and strange. I would rather not have them."
"I will myself put the diamond chain round your neck, and the circlet on your forehead, which it will become. For nature, at least, has stamped her patent of nobility on this brow, Jane. And I will clasp the bracelets on these fine wrists, and load these fairy-like fingers with rings."
"No, no, sir. Think of other subjects, and speak of other things, and in another strain. Don't address me as if I were a beauty. I am your plain, Quakerish governess."
"You are a beauty in my eyes, and a beauty just after the desire of my heart. Delicate and aerial."
"Puny and insignificant, you mean. You are dreaming, sir.
Oh, you are sneering. For God's sake, don't be ironical. I will make the world acknowledge you a beauty, too,
he went on, while I really became uneasy at the strain he had adopted, because I felt he was either deluding himself or trying to delude me.
I will attire my Jane in satin and lace, and she shall have roses in her hair, and I will cover the head I love best with a priceless veil.
And then you won't know me, sir, and I shall not be your Jane Eyre any longer, but an ape in a harlequin's jacket, a jay in borrowed plumes. I would as soon see you, Mr. Rochester, tricked out in stage trappings, as myself clad in a court lady's robe, and I don't call you handsome, sir, though I love you most dearly, far too dearly to flatter you. Don't flatter me. He pursued his theme, however, without noticing my deprecation.
This very day I shall take you in the carriage to Milcote, and you must choose some dresses for yourself. I told you we shall be married in 4 weeks. The wedding is to take place quietly, in the church down below yonder, and then I shall waft you away at once to town. After a brief stay there, I shall bear my treasure to regions nearer the sun, to French vineyards and Italian plains, and she shall see whatever is famous in old story and in modern record. She shall taste, too, of the life of cities, and she shall learn to value herself by just comparison with others.
Shall I travel? And with you, sir?
You shall sojourn at Paris, Rome, and Naples, at Florence, Venice, and Vienna. All the ground I have wandered over shall be retrodden by you. Wherever I stamped my hoof, your sylph's foot shall step also. 10 years since, I flew through Europe half mad, with disgust, hate, and rage as my companions. Now I shall revisit it healed and cleansed, with a very angel as my comforter.
I laughed at him as he said this. I am not an angel, I asserted, and I will not be one till I die. I will be myself. Mr. Rochester, you must neither expect nor exact anything celestial of me, for you will not get it, any more than I shall get it of you, which I do not at all anticipate.
What do you anticipate of me?
For a little while you will perhaps be as you are now. A very little while. And then you will turn cool, and then you will be capricious, and then you will be stern, and I shall have much ado to please you. But when you get well used to me, you will perhaps like me again. Like me, I say, not love me. I suppose your love will effervesce in 6 months, or less. I have observed in books written by men that period assigned as the farthest to which a husband's ardour extends. Yet, after all, as a friend and companion, I hope never to become quite distasteful to my dear master.
Distasteful? And like you again? I think I shall like you again, and yet again. And I will make you confess I do not only like, but love you. With truth, fervour, constancy.
Yet are you not capricious, sir?
To women who please me only by their faces, I am the very devil when I find out they have neither souls nor hearts, when they open to me a perspective of flatness, triviality, and perhaps imbecility, coarseness, and ill-temper. But to the clear eye and eloquent tongue, to the soul made of fire, and the character that bends but does not break, at once supple and stable, tractable and consistent, I am ever tender and true.
Had you ever experience of such a character, sir? Did you ever love such an one?
I love it now.
But before me, if I, indeed, in any respect come up to your difficult standard.
I never met your likeness. Jane, you please me, and you master me. You seem to submit, and I like the sense of pliancy you impart. And while I am twining the soft silken skein round my finger, it sends a thrill up my arm to my heart. I am influenced, conquered, and the influence is sweeter than I can express. And the conquest I undergo has a witchery beyond any triumph I can win. Why do you smile, Jane? What does that inexplicable, that uncanny turn of countenance mean?
I was thinking, sir. You will excuse the idea, it was involuntary. I was thinking of Hercules and Samson with their charmers.
You were, you little elfish.
Hush, sir. You don't talk very wisely just now, any more than those gentlemen acted very wisely. However, had they been married, they would no doubt by their severity as husbands have made up for their softness as suitors. And so will you, I fear. I wonder how you will answer me a year hence, should I ask a favour it does not suit your convenience or pleasure to grant.
Ask me something now, Jane. The least thing. I desire to be entreated.
Indeed I will, sir. I have my petition all ready.
Speak. But if you look up and smile with that countenance, I shall swear concession before I know to what, and that will make a fool of me.
Not at all, sir. I ask only this. Don't send for the jewels, and don't crown me with roses. You might as well put a border of gold lace round that plain pocket handkerchief you have there.
I might as well gild refined gold. I know it. Your request is granted, then, for the time. I will remand the order I dispatched to my banker. But you have not yet asked for anything. You have prayed a gift to be withdrawn. Try again.
Well then, sir, have the goodness to gratify my curiosity, which is much piqued on one point. He looked disturbed.
What? What?
He said hastily.
Curiosity is a dangerous petition. It is well I have not taken a vow to accord every request.
But there can be no danger in complying with this, sir.
Utter it, Jane. But I wish that instead of a mere inquiry into perhaps a secret, it was a wish for half my estate.
Now, King Ahasuerus, what do I want with half your estate? Do you think I am a Jew usurer, seeking good investment in land? I would much rather have all your confidence. You will not exclude me from your confidence if you admit me to your heart.
You are welcome to all my confidence that is worth having, Jane, but for God's sake, don't desire a useless burden. Don't long for poison. Don't turn out a downright Eve on my hands.
Why not, sir? You have just been telling me how much you like to be conquered, and how pleasant over-persuasion is to you. Don't you think I had better take advantage of the confession, and begin and coax and entreat, even cry and be sulky if necessary, for the sake of a mere essay of my power?
I dare you to any such experiment. Encroach, presume, and the game is up.
Is it, sir? You soon give in. How stern you look now. Your eyebrows have become as thick as my finger, and your forehead resembles what, in some very astonishing poetry, I once saw styled a blue-piled thunder loft. That will be your married look, sir, I suppose.
If that will be your married look, I, as a Christian, will soon give up the notion of consorting with a mere sprite or salamander. But what had you to ask, thing? Out with it.
There. You are less than civil now, and I like rudeness a great deal better than flattery. I had rather be a thing than an angel. This is what I have to ask. Why did you take such pains to make me believe you wished to marry Miss Ingram?
Is that all? Thank God it is no worse.
And now he unknit his black brows, looked down, smiling at me, and stroked my hair as if well pleased at seeing a danger averted.
I think I may confess, he continued, even although I should make you a little indignant, Jane, and I have seen what a fire spirit you can be when you are indignant. You glowed in the cool moonlight last night, when you mutinied against fate and claimed your rank as my equal. Janet, by the by, it was you who made me the offer.
Of course I did. But to the point, if you please, sir, Miss Ingram.
Well, I feigned courtship of Miss Ingram because I wished to render you as madly in love with me as I was with you. And I knew jealousy would be the best ally I could call in for the furtherance of that end.
Excellent. Now you are small. Not one whit bigger than the end of my little finger. It was a burning shame and a scandalous disgrace to act in that way. Did you think nothing of Miss Ingram's feelings, sir?
Her feelings are concentrated in one, pride, and that needs humbling. Were you jealous, Jane?
Never mind, Mr. Rochester. It is in no way interesting to you to know that. Answer me truly once more. Do you think Miss Ingram will not suffer from your dishonest coquetry? Won't she feel forsaken and deserted?
Impossible! When I told you how she, on the contrary, deserted me, the idea of my insolvency cooled, or rather extinguished, her flame in a moment.
You have a curious, designing mind, Mr. Rochester. I am afraid your principles on some points are eccentric.
My principles were never trained, Jane. They may have grown a little awry for want of attention.
Once again, seriously, may I enjoy the great good that has been vouchsafed to me, without fearing that anyone else is suffering the bitter pain I myself felt a while ago?
That you may, my good little girl. There is not another being in the world has the same pure love for me as yourself. For I lay that pleasant unction to my soul, Jane, a belief in your affection.
I turned my lips to the hand that lay on my shoulder. I loved him very much, more than I could trust myself to say, more than words had power to express.
"Ask something more," he said presently. "It is my delight to be entreated and to yield."
I was again ready with my request. "Communicate your intentions to Mrs. Fairfax, sir. She saw me with you last night in the hall, and she was shocked. Give her some explanation before I see her again. It pains me to be misjudged by so good a woman."
"Go to your room and put on your bonnet,"
he replied.
"I mean you to accompany me to Millcote this morning, and while you prepare for the drive, I will enlighten the old lady's understanding. Did she think, Janet, you had given the world for love and considered it well lost?"
"I believe she thought I had forgotten my station and yours, sir."
"Station, station! Your station is in my heart and on the necks of those who would insult you, now or hereafter. Go."
I was soon dressed, and when I heard Mr. Rochester quit Mrs. Fairfax's parlour, I hurried down to it. The old lady had been reading her morning portion of Scripture, the lesson for the day. Her Bible lay open before her, and her spectacles were upon it. Her occupation, suspended by Mr. Rochester's announcement, seemed now forgotten. Her eyes, fixed on the blank wall opposite, expressed the surprise of a quiet mind stirred by unwonted tidings. Seeing me, she roused herself. She made a sort of effort to smile, and framed a few words of congratulation. But the smile expired, and the sentence was abandoned unfinished. She put up her spectacles, shut the Bible, and pushed her chair back from the table.
"I feel so astonished," she began.
"I hardly know what to say to you, Miss Eyre. I have surely not been dreaming, have I? Sometimes I half fall asleep when I'm sitting alone and fancy things that have never happened. It has seemed to me more than once when I have been in a doze that my dear husband, who died 15 years since, has come in and sat down beside me. And that I have even heard him call me by my name, Alice, as he used to do. Now, can you tell me whether it is actually true that Mr. Rochester has asked you to marry him? Don't laugh at me, but I really thought he came in here 5 minutes ago and said that in a month he would be his wife."
"He has said the same thing to me," I replied.
"He has? Do you believe him? Have you accepted him?"
"Yes." She looked at me bewildered.
"I could never have thought it. He is a proud man. All the Rochesters were proud. And his father, at least, liked money. He, too, has always been called careful. He means to marry you?"
"He tells me so." She surveyed my whole person. In her eyes I read that they had there found no charm powerful enough to solve the enigma.
"It passes me," she continued. "But no doubt it is true, since you say so. How it will answer, I cannot tell. I really don't know. Equality of position and fortune is often advisable in such cases. And there are 20 years of difference in your ages. He might almost be your father."
"No, indeed, Mrs. Fairfax," exclaimed I, nettled. "He is nothing like my father. No one who saw us together would suppose it for an instant. Mr. Rochester looks as young, and is as young, as some men at 25.
"Is it really for love he is going to marry you?"
she asked. I was so hurt by her coldness and scepticism that the tears rose to my eyes.
"I am sorry to grieve you," pursued the widow, "but you are so young, and so little acquainted with men. I wish to put you on your guard. It is an old saying that all is not gold that glitters,
And in this case I do fear there will be something found to be different to what either you or I expect. Why? Am I a monster? I said. Is it impossible that Mr. Rochester should have a sincere affection for me?
No, you are very well, and much improved of late. And Mr. Rochester, I dare say, is fond of you. I've always noticed that you were a sort of pet of his. There are times when, for your sake, I've been a little uneasy at his marked preference and have wished to put you on your guard, but I did not like to suggest even the possibility of wrong. I knew such an idea would shock, perhaps offend you, and you were so discreet and so thoroughly modest and sensible. I hoped you might be trusted to protect yourself. Last night I cannot tell you what I suffered when I sought all over the house and could find you nowhere, nor the master either, and then at 12 o'clock saw you come in with him.
Well, never mind that now, I interrupted impatiently. It is enough that all was right.
I hope all will be right in the end, she said. But believe me, you cannot be too careful. Try and keep Mr. Rochester at a distance. Distrust yourself as well as him. Gentlemen in his station are not accustomed to marry their governesses.
I was growing truly irritated. Happily, Adele ran in.
Let me go! Let me go to Millcote too, she cried. Mr. Rochester won't, though there is so much room in the new garage. Beg him to let me go, mademoiselle.
That I will, Adele. And I hastened away with her, glad to quit my gloomy monitress. The carriage was ready. They were bringing it round to the front, and my master was pacing the pavement, Pilot following him backwards and forwards. Adele may accompany us, may she not, sir?
I told her no. I'll have no brats. I'll have only you.
Do let her go, Mr. Rochester, if you please. It would be better.
Not it. She will be a restraint.
He was quite peremptory, both in look and voice. The chill of Mrs. Fairfax's warnings and the damp of her doubts were upon me. Something of unsubstantiality and uncertainty had beset my hopes. I half lost the sense of power over him. I was about mechanically to obey him, without further remonstrance, but as he helped me into the carriage, he looked at my face.
"What is the matter?" he asked. "All the sunshine is gone. Do you really wish the bairn to go? Will it annoy you if she is left behind?"
"I would far rather she went, sir."
"Then offer your bonnet and back like a flash of lightning,"
cried he to Adele. She obeyed him with what speed she might.
"After all, a single morning's interruption will not matter much," said he, "when I mean shortly to claim you, your thoughts, conversation, and company for life."
Adele, when lifted in, commenced kissing me, by way of expressing her gratitude for my intercession. She was instantly stowed away into a corner on the other side of him. She then peeped round to where I sat. So stern a neighbour was too restrictive. To him, in his present fractious mood, she dared whisper no observations, nor ask of him any information. "Let her come to me," I entreated. "She will perhaps trouble you, sir. There is plenty of room on this side." He handed her over as if she had been a lapdog.
"I'll send her to school yet," he said,
but now he was smiling. Adele heard him, and asked if she was to go to school sans mademoiselle?
"Yes," he replied, "absolutely sans mademoiselle. For I am to take mademoiselle to the moon, and there I shall seek a cave in one of the white valleys among the volcano tops, and mademoiselle shall live with me there, and only me."
"She will have nothing to eat. You will starve her," observed Adele.
"I shall gather manna for her morning and night. The plains and hillsides in the moon are bleached with manna, Adele."
"She will want to warm herself. What will she do for a fire?"
"Fire rises out of the lunar mountains. When she is cold, I'll carry her up to a peak and lay her down on the edge of a crater."
"Oh, qu'elle sera mal, peu confortable, and her clothes, they will wear out. How can she get new ones?"
Mr. Rochester professed to be puzzled.
"Hmm," said he. "What would you do, Adele? Cudgel your brains for an expedient. How would a white or a pink cloud answer for a gown, do you think? And one could cut a pretty enough scarf out of a rainbow."
She is far better as she is, concluded Adele, after musing some time.
Besides, she would get tired of living with only you in the moon. If I were Mademoiselle, I would never consent to go with you.
She has consented. She has pledged her word.
But you can't get her there. There is no road to the moon. It is all air, and neither you nor she can fly.
Adele, look at that field.
We were now outside Thornfield gates, and bowling lightly along the smooth road to Milcote, where the dust was well laid by the thunderstorm, and where the low hedges and lofty timber trees on each side glistened green and rain-refreshed.
In that field, Adele, I was walking late one evening, about a fortnight since, the evening of the day you helped me to make hay in the orchard meadows, and as I was tired with raking swathes, I sat down to rest me on a stile, and there I took out a little book and a pencil, and began to write about a misfortune that befell me long ago, and a wish I had for happy days to come. I was writing away very fast, though daylight was fading from the leaf, when something came up the path and stopped 2 yards off me. I looked at it. It was a little thing with a veil of gossamer on its head. I beckoned it to come near me. It stood soon at my knee. I never spoke to it, and it never spoke to me in words. But I read its eyes, and it read mine, and our speechless colloquy was to this effect. It was a fairy, and come from Elfland, it said, and its errand was to make me happy. I must go with it out of the common world to a lonely place, such as the moon, for instance. And it nodded its head towards her horn, rising over Hay Hill. It told me of the alabaster cave and silver veil where we might live. I said I should like to go, but reminded it, as you did me, that I had no wings to fly. "Oh," returned the fairy, "that does not signify. Here is a talisman will remove all difficulties," and she held out a pretty gold ring. "Put it," she said, "on the fourth finger of my left hand, and I am yours, and you are mine, and we shall leave earth, and make our own heaven yonder." She nodded again at the moon. "The ring, Adele, is in my breeches pocket, under the disguise of a sovereign, but I mean soon to change it to a ring again."
"But what has Mademoiselle to do with it?" "I don't care for the fairy. You said it was Mademoiselle you would take to the moon."
"Mademoiselle is a fairy," he said, whispering mysteriously.
Whereupon I told her not to mind his badinage, and she, on her part, evinced a fund of genuine French scepticism, denominating Mr. Rochester
un vrai menteur,
and assuring him that she made no account whatever of his
conte de fées,
and that,
du reste, il n'y avait pas de fées, et quand même il y en avait.
She was sure they would never appear to him, nor ever give him rings, or offer to live with him in the moon. The hour spent at Milcote was a somewhat harassing one to me. Mr. Rochester obliged me to go to a certain silk warehouse. There I was ordered to choose half a dozen dresses. I hated the business. I begged leave to defer it. No, it should be gone through with now. By dint of entreaties expressed in energetic whispers, I reduced the half dozen to 2. These, however, he vowed he would select himself. With anxiety I watched his eye rove over the gay stores. He fixed on a rich silk of the most brilliant amethyst dye, and a superb pink satin. I told him in a new series of whispers that he might as well buy me a gold gown and a silver bonnet at once. I should certainly never venture to wear his choice. With infinite difficulty, for he was stubborn as a stone, I persuaded him to make an exchange in favour of a sober black satin and pearl-grey silk. It might pass for the present, he said, but he would yet see me glittering like a parterre. Glad was I to get him out of the silk warehouse, and then out of the jeweller's shop. The more he bought me, the more my cheek burned with a sense of annoyance and degradation. As we re-entered the carriage, and I sat back feverish and fagged, I remembered what, in the hurry of events dark and bright, I had wholly forgotten. The letter of my uncle, John Eyre, to Mrs. Reed. His intention to adopt me, and make me his legatee. It would indeed be a relief, I thought, if I had ever so small an independency. I never can bear being dressed like a doll by Mr. Rochester, or sitting like a second Danae with the golden shower falling daily round me. I will write to Madeira the moment I get home, and tell my Uncle John I am going to be married, and to whom, if I had but a prospect of one day bringing Mr. Rochester an accession of fortune, I could better endure to be kept by him now. And somewhat relieved by this idea, which I failed not to execute that day, I ventured once more to meet my master's and lover's eye, which most pertinaciously sought mine, though I averted both face and gaze. He smiled, and I thought his smile was such as a sultan might, in a blissful and fond moment, bestow on a slave his gold and gems had enriched. I crushed his hand, which was ever hunting mine, vigorously, and thrust it back to him red with the passionate pressure. "You need not look in that way," I said. "If you do, I'll wear nothing but my old lowered frocks to the end of the chapter. I'll be married in this lilac gingham, and you may make a dressing gown for yourself out of the pearl-grey silk, and an infinite series of waistcoats out of the black satin." He chuckled. He rubbed his hands.
"Oh, it is rich to see and hear her," he exclaimed. "Is she original? Is she piquant? I would not exchange this one little English girl for the Grand Turk's whole seraglio, gazelle eyes, houri forms, and all."
The Eastern illusion bit me again. "I'll not stand you an inch in the stead of a seraglio," I said, "so don't consider me an equivalent for one. If you have a fancy for anything in that line, away with you, sir, to the bazaars of Stamboul without delay, and lay out in extensive slave purchases some of that spare cash you seem at a loss to spend satisfactorily here."
"And what will you do, Janet, while I am bargaining for so many tons of flesh and such an assortment of black eyes?"
"I'll be preparing myself to go out as a missionary to preach liberty to them that are enslaved, your harem inmates amongst the rest. I'll get admitted there, and I'll stir up mutiny, and you, three-tailed bashaw as you are, sir, shall in a trice find yourself fettered amongst our hands, nor will I for one consent to cut your bonds till you have signed a charter, the most liberal that despot ever yet conferred."
"I would consent to be at your mercy, Jane."
"I would have no mercy, Mr. Rochester, if you supplicated for it with an eye like that. While you looked so, I should be certain that whatever charter you might grant under coercion, your first act when released would be to violate its conditions."
"Why, Jane, what would you have? I fear you will compel me to go through a private marriage ceremony besides that performed at the altar. You will stipulate, I see, for peculiar terms. What will they be?"
"I only want an easy mind, sir, not crushed by crowded obligations. Do you remember what you said of Céline Varon? Of the diamonds, the cashmeres you gave her? I will not be your English Céline Varon. I shall continue to act as Adele's governess. By that I shall earn my board and lodging and £30 a year besides. I'll furnish my own wardrobe out of that money, and you shall give me nothing but—"
"Well, but what?"
"Your regard. And if I give you mine in return, that debt will be quit."
"Well, for cool native impudence and pure innate pride, you haven't your equal," said he.
We were now approaching Thornfield.
"Will it please you to dine with me today?" he asked, as we re-entered the gates.
"No, thank you, sir."
"And what for, no thank you, if one may inquire?"
"I never have dined with you, sir, and I see no reason why I should now, till—"
"Till what? You delight in half-phrases."
"Till I can't help it."
"Do you suppose I eat like an ogre or a ghoul, that you dread being the companion of my repast?"
"I have formed no supposition on the subject, sir, but I want to go on as usual for another month."
"You will give up your governessing slavery at once?"
"Indeed, begging your pardon, sir, I shall not. I shall just go on with it as usual. I shall keep out of your way all day, as I have been accustomed to do. You may send for me in the evening when you feel disposed to see me, and I'll come then, but at no other time."
"I want a smoke, Jane, or a pinch of snuff to comfort me under all this. Pour me donner une contenance, as Adele would say. And unfortunately I have neither my cigar case nor my snuff box. But listen, whisper. It is your time now, little tyrant, but it will be mine presently. and when once I have fairly seized you to have and to hold, I'll just, figuratively speaking, attach you to a chain like this.